I would say that no government on earth should ever squander its resources on buying weaponry, on storing or developing or using weaponry. I would say that to the government of Iraq. But I would also say it to the government of the United States, because I come from the country that has developed, sold, stored, and used more weapons of mass destruction than any other country on earth.
From the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, it's time for the Weekly Freak Show. It's Sunday, November 4th, 2001, and my name's the V-Man. I'll be your host for this one-hour examination of the news and events not heard in, or glanced over by, the corporate-controlled media. On this week's program, Richard Sanders of the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade discusses how the Taliban and Osama bin Laden were funded by the U.S. government. Then we'll hear about the effects of economic sanctions on Iraq from Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness, and later Hans von Sponeck, former head of the UN Oil for Food Program for Iraq, discusses why he stepped down from the position. Plus, this week's Spotlight Sound. Stand by for the Weekly Freak Show, coming up next. Richard Sanders is coordinator for COAT, the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade. They are a national network of individuals and organizations based in Ottawa, Canada, that began in late 1988 to organize opposition to ArmX 89, Canada's largest weapons bazaar. The Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade has continued to expose and oppose Canada's role in the international arms trade, particularly to foreign governments engaged in war or which violates human rights. Richard Sanders talks about his organization, COAT, as well as how the Taliban and Osama bin Laden were funded by the United States government. He also discusses the importance of nonviolence in these trying times. He was interviewed by Freak Radio's John Malkin. They begin with a discussion of Canada's role in the global arms trade.
Well, here in Canada, there's a widespread myth that Canada promotes peace and is largely a peacekeeping nation, stands for peace in different international fora. And this is a view that Canadians have of themselves, and it's an image that Canadians have around the world with others. But it's actually not at all true, and one of the major tasks that we face in the peace movement is trying to debunk this mythology of Canada, the great peacekeeper, great peacekeeping nation. The reality is really quite different. For instance, Canada's very involved in military exports. We export largely to the United States. The United States is our main buyer, and there are no restrictions or constraints whatsoever on military export. Companies don't even need a military export permit to sell equipment to the U.S., and we export to more than 100 other countries around the world, including many of the most violent, aggressive violators of human rights and labor rights around the world. So this is one example of Canada's involvement in crimes against peace and crimes against humanity. We've joined with the United States in several recent wars, the war against Iraq in 91 and the NATO war against Yugoslavia. So our warplanes have taken part in bombing missions during those two wars, and also during this current war against Afghanistan. Canadian military is right in there supporting the U.S. and Britain in those wars. What else? Well, Canada is the largest exporter of uranium in the world. Uranium, of course, is the fuel for nuclear weapons. We allow NATO countries to test their warplanes over Canadian airspace, or more correctly, over airspace of First Nations. In some cases, these are Native people that have never signed any treaties giving over or ceding their territory to the Canadian government. Canadian government allows the testing of these warplanes and the training of pilots in low-level test flights, and we used to test cruise missiles here in Canada. That was done over in Canadian airspace. We also allow nuclear warships and submarines to come into our harbors, and we allow the U.S. to test torpedoes in our waters. The list goes on and on, but basically a lot of this is not well known around the world. or even in Canada. So the peace movement really has its work cut out for us just in doing public education about Canada's role in participating in wars and aiding and abetting in various crimes through its arms trade and through testing, training, equipping various governments around the world.
I first heard about the Coalition to Oppose the Arms Trade on the Internet. I received an email with the petition that your organization crafted after the attacks on New York. And I'd like you to describe what that petition was and what's happened with that.
What it is, it's not exactly a petition. It's a bit of a different animal from a petition. Usually, I think of a petition as something that people sign and then they send it to the government. The government may or may not do anything with it, and then it disappears. What this is a global appeal for no more violence, and it's also combined with a pledge of nonviolence, so it's bit stronger than just a petition. And it basically says some of the things that I've been saying. Basically, it expresses sadness for the suffering, the deaths of thousands in New York, Washington, Pennsylvania, and that we people from around the world denounce these acts of terrorism against innocent civilians, and we believe that military retaliation in response will only accelerate the cycle of fear, anger, and violence, and that we support international law, et cetera, and we mourn for the lives of those died on September 11th, but we also mourn for the lives of those around the world that are dying from the violence inflicted by terrorism, war, lack of food, medicine, water, and housing. And then the pledge says, standing firmly together, we will embrace nonviolence to stop the cycle of violence from spiraling even farther out of control. We join in solidarity with others from around the world to build our common security through disarmament, dialogue, and social justice, not through violent attacks and military might. We pledge ourselves to support nonviolence as the way towards a peace with justice. And in the first 10 days after we launched that, we were getting 1,000 people signing on to that every day, 1,000 people a day. It was quite amazing. Now we've got quite a huge list. It's up to about 15,000 now. And it's now online in 20 different languages. The appeal has been translated by volunteer people from around the world, from various different countries. It's been translated into 20 languages. People from about 130 countries have signed it, and it's not just being collected for the purpose of delivering it to one place. We're asking everybody to distribute this pledge and this appeal as widely as they can to everyone that they think should see it and should sign it. So we're asking people to send it to their friends, their family, their colleagues, whatever politicians they think should see it, organizations, the media. You can also write comments. So you can write a little comment, and you can go up to this website and see this list of thousands of names from all over the world, and you can see what country, the name of the person, the country they come from, what group they're affiliated with, and then a lot of people write a little comment. So it's like a blackboard. It's a place where people can almost write graffiti, in a sense. They can write a little comment, and it's really encouraging. It's empowering to see the names of these people from all over the world, and it looks like an amazing crowd of people, you know. It's sort of an online vigil. It's an online coming together of people from all around the world that are saying, you know, enough violence, we should pursue a nonviolent course. That's been really encouraging and kind of fun to see that.
What's the website for that?
To go directly to that, it's the 3ws.flora.org/coat, C-O-A-T. Or if people go to our website, they can get to it from there. Our website is 3ws.ncf.ca/coat. And the NCF stands for National Capital Freenet. So it's www.ncf.ca/coat.
And the website is really impressive. There's a lot of interesting articles ranging from the history of the CIA to principles of nonviolence and a history of direct disarmament actions. And I think it's really important to provide models of successful nonviolence, and I'm really pleased to see such a nonviolent aspect to the work that you're doing.
Well, thanks. It is important to report on these nonviolent actions that are going on around the world. There's a lot of stuff that is being done that's very encouraging, and it's, you know, we're just doing our little bit to pull some of that together so that people can find out about it. In the last decades, wars have killed an increasing number of civilians, that in fact, it's well accepted now, that well accepted fact that about 90% of the people killed in wars, the victims of wars, are innocent civilians. So therefore, we have to agree that war is terrorism, and we have to look at who perpetrates war and who then are the biggest terrorists. And another thing, in terms of solutions to this long-term struggle to get rid of terrorism, because it is a very long-term struggle, it's been going on for thousands of years, we have to stop, when I say we, I mean our governments, particularly the United States government has to pay attention to this one, is that governments have to stop arming and training and financing terrorists. This is a good way to prevent terrorism, is to stop funding and arming and training them. We all know now about how bin Laden was working for the U.S., for the CIA. The same goes for Manuel Noriega, and Saddam Hussein also was the U.S. guy. He was the chosen ally during the war against Iran, and a million people were killed in that war. So it makes sense to not arm and train these guys, and then maybe they won't have so much ability to launch terrorist acts, because eventually it'll come back, it'll blow back against you.
Yeah, it seems to be a very clear pattern at this point that the United States is arming and training terrorists who at the time are usually called freedom fighters, who then end up becoming independent and are then called terrorists. What specific details do you know about the creation of the Taliban through the CIA and the United States government?
There was a coup in Afghanistan, I think it was in about 1975, and a socialist or communist government came into power there because of that military coup. And they tried, that government tried to do certain things that the fundamentalist Muslim, for lack of a better word, I'd say fanatics, didn't appreciate. They were allowing women to go to girls to go to school. Women were becoming doctors. There were women going on television as reporters, and those were among some of the new government policies that the religious right in Afghanistan, the Muslim fanatics, didn't appreciate. And so they started launching terrorist attacks against that socialist, communist government, whatever you want to call it, in Afghanistan in the late 70s. And they asked for help from the Soviet Union to come in and help fight these terrorists that were attacking the daycares. And they were like Contras, basically, attacking daycare centers and hospitals and different government services. And so the United States, actually, this became the largest CIA covert war in U.S. history, and I believe there was something like $6 or $7 billion, billion with a B, dollars poured into that war to fight against the Soviets. And bin Laden was in charge of some kind of a military base that was the sort of last base that that these fundamentalists would come to from all around the world before their final march into Afghanistan. And so he apparently kept a very detailed list of all the people that came through his base, and he ended up with one wicked mailing list of terrorists. And he was working for the United States intelligence services in helping to coordinate the military attacks against Afghanistan and the Soviet-backed government that was there at that time. Now, another interesting thing that hasn't really, then this has pretty much come out and is basic sort of common knowledge here in Canada now about bin Laden. And I don't know whether this has reached the state of being sort of common knowledge down in the States, but it's pretty much common knowledge here and probably everywhere around the world. But what isn't very well known is that there are these Muslim guerrilla mujahideen fighting troops, whatever you want to call them, that are still operating in Macedonia that have connections with bin Laden's organization, and they are being aided by the U.S. even now. So it's not a matter just that bin Laden's gang were, you know, helping the U.S. years and years ago, you know, 10, 20 years ago. These people are still working to promote U.S. foreign policies in Macedonia right now.
It's so hypocritical.
Yeah.
And it brings to mind also the fact that the United States was dropping, along with massive bombs, and is dropping, you know, huge bombs upon people of Afghanistan, but was also dropping food.
I saw a thing on television, an interview with a man from an organization called Conscience International, and he's an American, and he's based in Georgia. his name is Jennings, and he was being interviewed on Canadian television, and he was saying about that dropping of food and aid packages. He made a very interesting comment. He said that this was a CIA psychological operations effort, that the aid packages that were being dropped were not terribly effective in terms of helping people, and that it was being done purely to persuade the public here that everything was being done that could be done to help the people of Afghanistan. But I think the reality is that we've seen other aid agencies coming forward and saying that because of this war and because of the hundreds of thousands of refugees that are fleeing the country to avoid the bombing, that we may see as many as 100,000 people dying this winter. The winters are very severe there, and also I don't know whether you got this news, but I think it was this morning. Was it this morning or was it yesterday morning that the Red Cross storage facility or warehouse or something in Kabul was bombed by the United States? They bombed the Red Cross warehouses and destroyed a third of their supplies, and it was mostly tents and blankets. It wasn't food.
Propaganda in the United States is so strong that a lot of people believe that that sort of thing just happens in these situations, and they're necessary collateral damage, as it's called.
Well, that sounds a lot like something that a terrorist might say. You know, it's, well, you know, innocent people have to die. That's just the way it is. But people like myself are saying that we shouldn't kill innocent civilians, whether they're in the United States or anywhere else. No innocent civilians should die for political purposes, or people shouldn't be going around murdering innocent people. It's immoral, it's illegal, and it won't work. This is not a solution to terrorism. It's actually going to cause more terrorism. It's exactly what bin Laden probably hoped. It was probably kind of a trap that he set. Because what will happen is thousands more people will become angry and will become filled with hatred against the United States. And those are the conditions that you would want if you were trying to create terrorism, is to create hatred against your country. If the United States wants to create thousands of very angry people that are filled with hatred against them and against their government and against their country, then this is exactly what they should be doing, is bombing innocent civilians in Afghanistan.
The United States government has created a new government Department of Homeland Security. Among peace activists here, there's a lot of discussion and a lot of concern that civil liberties are going to be diminished. There's even discussion of expanding the control of borders by the U.S. government to a wider arena than the United States, but to include all of North America, for example. I wonder if you've heard much about that in Canada, and also what kind of civil liberties legislation has been passed recently in Canada.
We have been hearing about the Homeland Securities. Homeland Security legislation in the United States, and it certainly does sound pretty draconian. Of course, it's important to try to use the full extent of the law to trap terrorists, but it remains to be seen how this is going to be used to curtail the civil liberties of people like myself that are advocating nonviolence, or other people that are just wrongfully accused. We have a new law that's working its way through the process now. It was just tabled in our parliament this week on Monday, and it gives the police here some new powers, increased ability to do surveillance on people. And another thing that they can now do is preventative arrests. They can arrest people before they've actually committed a crime, just because they're suspects. There's a discussion, there's quite a wide-ranging discussion going on across Canada as to whether this new law will go too far. We'll have to just wait and see how it's used or misused by the security forces here. We know that our Royal Canadian Mounted Police, when they used to be in charge of internal security spy stuff, they got into a lot of trouble back in the 70s and had to give up that role, and they created a whole new thing called CSIS, Canadian Security Intelligence Service, which works closely with your CIA. And the RCMP turned over to our National Archives tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of files. If you stacked up those files, they would be more than a kilometer high. And it's files that they collected over the decades on peace groups and churches and political groups and immigrants, and it's all their spying files that are available in the archives if you do an access to information.
So there was a sort of a simultaneous counterintelligence program in Canada like there was in the United States.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Oh, yeah, they've been monitoring and putting peace activists and all sorts of different political activists, putting them under surveillance for decades, unions and students groups, and for sure.
Among peace groups and peace activists here and people involved in social change, there is a mixed feeling, I guess inside of me too, there's a mixed feeling. There's a lot of fear present now. There have been mailings of envelopes that have anthrax, and there's fear that civil liberties will be squashed. And then there's desire to try and oppose the U.S. government's actions in Afghanistan. And also, there's a really broadly held view that inside of all of this is a kernel of new understanding. And you mentioned earlier this possibility that perhaps people will wake up to the notion that civilians getting killed, or people getting killed anywhere, is unhealthy and not positive and not helpful anywhere. When we have sat back for so long and the propaganda has told us that this was necessary over there and that was necessary in another place, and I wonder if there are those feelings in Canada and in your organization?
Certainly, yeah, exactly how you describe. There's also another factor is that some people are, I'm sure, quite concerned about speaking out. On the one hand, this is the time when people have to speak out as loudly and clearly as they can to stand up for nonviolence and to stop the cycle of violence. But there's other things that tug away at us. We're concerned about our own safety. Are we going to become victims of this increased surveillance and paranoia amongst our fellow civilians, our citizens, and security people? So people are a bit scared to speak out. It's pretty scary times. This whole anthrax thing as well, it seems to be scaring people here. Even though there haven't been any cases of it, there are these false alarms, like fake anthrax incidents, and the media is reporting on these things, and it's just getting people more uptight and sort of feeding into this whole fear. It's sort of a fear-mongering operation, and people then think, well, you know, we really do have to crack down and make sure that we're safe and secure, and our safety and our security take precedence or become more of a priority than the lives of thousands of other people that are being killed now because of the bombing.
Kathy Kelly has been active in the peace movement for many years. In 1988, she served 9 months of a 1-year prison sentence for planting corn on nuclear missile silo sites. As a pacifist and war tax resister, she has refused to pay all of her federal income tax for 18 years. Kathy Kelly traveled to Iraq for the first time on the eve of the Gulf War as a member of the Gulf Peace Team, a delegation of 72 volunteers from 18 countries that set up on the Saudi Arabian border after Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. In the mid-1990s, she helped start Voices in the Wilderness, a campaign to end the UN-imposed, US-led economic sanctions destroying Iraq. Since 1996, Voices in the Wilderness has sent 39 delegations to hospitals and clinics in Baghdad, Basra, and Mosul, breaking the siege imposed by the sanctions and creating an extensive network among Iraq's people. U.S. authorities have threatened the group with 12 years in prison for violating the State Department law regarding travel to Iraq. Kathy Kelly has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize not once, but twice, in the year 2000 and again this year. The events of September 11th brought to an early conclusion a 40-day fast and vigil Kathy Kelly and 11 others were conducting in front of the United Nations building in New York City to draw attention to their call for an end to the U.S.-imposed economic sanctions on Iraq. She spoke in Santa Cruz on November 1st with Hans von Sponeck, former UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq. Kathy Kelly of Voices in the Wilderness.
So I'd like to speak a little bit about some of the voices from Iraq that have certainly helped me have an overwhelming experience of that from another culture, but also to try to represent some of those voices that have not been heard, and I think they've been muted in a sense by our own might. So I would like to start with the first children I ever met in Iraq. I had been in Iraq during the Gulf War, went back in with an early study team, and was coming out of Iraq. And as we were driving along a desert road, and the drivers, understandably, you know, they drive like pilots. There was hardly any petrol, so very few cars on the road, speeding along in a Red Crescent vehicle, their equivalent of Red Cross. And suddenly a little bevy of children, tots, might have been 3 or 4 years old, came tumbling down the hill. They were stretching out their arms and touching their lips and mimicking the formation of chapatis, the bread of the poor. And they were that hungry, or maybe their parents had told them that now's your moment, that they really took a huge risk, I thought, trying to stop our vehicle. And Taha, the driver, a Palestinian who was just noted for having nerves of steel, this man had driven in and out from Jordan to Iraq all through the war, knew where to swerve to miss every crater, wouldn't spend hardly more than an overnight in between trips, taking refugees out, bringing humanitarian relief in. He made sure he didn't hit any of these kids, clutched the wheel and said, "We cannot stop. We have not all what they need. Anyway, we stop, there'd be many more." And he sped along. Well, another group quickly assembled and came tumbling down the hill. Same thing. And when the third group of children came down that hillside, Taha hunched over that steering wheel, and he sobbed and he sobbed and he sobbed, the man with nerves of steel, because he didn't have what they needed. I remember maybe 6 months later back in the United States reading a very cynical account from a reporter, a U.S. reporter, who said that was such a deplorable, standard, orchestrated way of trying to tug at people's heartstrings. I guess he'd seen the same thing. And that troubled me a bit. I never told that story for a long time. But I guess it was last summer we started to get the recently declassified 1991 Defense Intelligence Agency report from January 22, 1991, that told in 38 very, very chilling paragraphs how, in fact, there had been an orchestrated awareness that just 6 more months of economic sanctions, this was in 1991 in January, they could say that 6 more months of economic sanctions and Iraq's water treatment system would be thoroughly degraded. And then the report goes on to enumerate, almost as though those writing it had a crystal ball, just what epidemic proportions of disease, waterborne disease, could be expected to afflict the civilian population. Typhus, cholera, dysentery, diarrhea. And that was orchestrated. And so I begin to think about those children. And maybe the adults talked them into running down the hillside. Maybe it was a way to try to get an image out to hearts and minds beyond Iraq. And maybe it was orchestrated. But that just doesn't seem so evil or wrongful in comparison to the orchestration of what I think we have to honestly call biological warfare that's been waged through economic sanctions against Iraqi people. You don't have to place contaminants into a water system, prevent people from getting the spare parts that they need to repair it over a span of now 11 years, and you can bet that there will be biological elements creating widespread disease. And yet these are voices that it's so very, very hard for us to hear. Well, those little tots are teenagers today, and I have had a chance to hear the voices of teenagers, kids that we dwelt with while staying in Basra for the 7 weeks over the summer that Scott mentioned. Kids who have substandard education, who say, "What is internet?" Who might very often be sick themselves still with contaminated water. We spent more money on 2 days of bottled water for our team of 5 than the household I lived with had for the entire month. There was an electricity outage such that generally for 10 to 14 hours, often 14 hours a day, no electricity. We slept on the rooftop. It was so ungodly hot, you know, with temperatures of 140 degrees. And it seemed like it just vaguely, there might be something like a hint of a breeze in the middle of the morning. But what woke me up every morning was the sound of a U.S. airplane flying overhead. Nearly every day, U.S. warplanes flew. Do you know, some of the children in Iraq don't understand the concept of a passenger plane, because with the embargo, they haven't seen airplanes with passengers. They've only seen warplanes. And that was my closest brush with high technology, because you couldn't even place a phone call in between neighborhoods in Basra, much less be able to call beyond. So people that are isolated, people that are beleaguered. When I came back to the United States, I read in the paper that Miss Madeleine Albright said that religious people who go to Iraq and think that economic sanctions cause suffering are in an Alice in Wonderland fantasy. But I think that if you think that when you prevent people from selling what they have in order to get what they need, it'll cause suffering, that's not fantasy, that's reality. Days later, Miss Albright said that the problem is simple. He's the villain. It's his fault. But if you are Dr. Firas Abdul Abbas, and the price of a blood bag on the black market is 75,000 Iraqi dinar, as it was that summer, and an average household earns 5,000 Iraqi dinar, and you start your day with five blood bags, but by the end of the day you're down to one, and on one end of the hospital there's a woman in the obstetrics ward who is hemorrhaging, on another end of the hospital there's a newborn baby who needs a transfusion, and they both need that one blood bag that you've got. And Dr. Firas Abdul Abbas said to us, "Believe me, I think this worst day of my life. I must make decision, and I decide to give blood bag to the woman, the mother. She have other people in her family, and they need her. And then I go to bedside of the mother and Nauras, and together we stay with the baby until Nauras die. And really, I believe I make decision that kill that baby." No, the problem is not simple. And it must have something to do, if we're going to talk about villainry, with the United States and the United Kingdom placing $4 billion worth of items on hold, and many of them, if not most, medical equipment, medical supplies, serums for vaccines, and yes, blood bags. If you are Maghreb and you're 18 and you're quite beautiful, your sister at age 18 has just given birth to a baby, but you don't think anyone's ever going to marry you, and you take the foreigner aside into a room and you unbutton the top of your bodice and you show the scars that cover your chest and your thighs and your shoulders, and they're 3 inches long and 1 inch wide, and they were inflicted on you when a United States bomb hit your home on Missile Street in Jumeirah, where I stayed that summer. And you say to the foreigner, "Am I ugly?" The problem is not simple. And it must have something to do with the country that manufactured and shipped and dropped that bomb on your home. So no, I don't think we can accept the facile explanations of U.S. policy that have been given to us in the past. I think instead it's a good idea for me to listen to a little boy in Fallujah, to hear his voice as well. He was maybe about 10 years old, staring at me pensively, and there was an interpreter with us. And I asked the interpreter, "Could you ask that little boy what he's thinking?" We were in a crowded marketplace, but this boy just had kind of stood his ground and was staring at me. And the interpreter posed the question, and the young boy said, "I am a scholar of the faith." I said, "Yes, but ask him what he's thinking." And the question was posed again, and this child, he seemed to be a poor child. I don't know how educated he was. Never took his eyes off of me. And he said, "Tell her I am thinking that when I grow up, I will be a fighter pilot and bomb the United States." I have to tell you, that's been unusual in my experience. And yet, I wonder, can we count on the magnanimity and the generosity and the friendship that's been extended to us as Americans in trip after trip? Just Voices alone has sent 39 delegations over to Iraq. Can we count on that to continue into a next generation of kids who often go to bed hungry, wake up hungry, have bleak prospects, go to substandard schools, all of them knowing people who've died at either young ages or infant ages? Shall we expect that these children are going to have benign views toward the United States? I think that we could go back to Madeleine Albright's image when she said that people who go over to Iraq are in an Alice in Wonderland fantasy if they think the economic sanctions cause suffering. Well, you know, Alice ended up walking into the mirror. I'd like to think about a mirror together with you for a moment, but it's one that the current Secretary of State, Colin Powell, has given us. And Colin Powell said, on the day of the September 11th attack, when the second Twin Tower was hit, he went on CNN, and he said the people who perpetrated this attack think that by destroying buildings and killing people, you can achieve a political goal. And Colin Powell said they're wrong, but let's let that be our mirror. By destroying buildings and killing people, you can't achieve a political goal that will all guarantee security, the kind of security that people in this country now crave. And I would submit that instead that security will be founded in forging bonds of understanding, bonds of compassion, and that's going to require us to listen so much better to cries that have come from people that are often considered to be faceless and nameless, and I'll bet they often feel that we regard them like dust under our shoes. I've so admired the New York Times for printing the name and the picture and an obituary of every person killed at the World Trade Center. Not an issue has gone by without doing that. But what a wonderful thing it can be if in magnanimity and humility and honesty we eventually can begin to hear that there are many other targeted civilians in this world, some of them targeted by the squandering of our wealth that's gone into weaponry, many targeted by economic warfare that we've waged, many targeted by invasions and interventions that we've made. And from that context, try to work toward the forgiveness and the healing that our world needs so much right now. Thank you.
She was picking yellow flowers, smiling at the sunlight, weaving stems to make a necklace, working hard to get it all right. She reached out to trade it for the bread her mama brought her. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. Her feet were bare as mine were. When I grew up in the country, and just like her, I watched my mother hanging out the laundry. Now she's grabbed some clothes and darted off. And her mama chased and caught her. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. Now she's running down the alleyway, dust rising up behind her. Hides beneath the rubble where nobody can find her. And when she tires and walks back home, her mama tells her that she loves her. And when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. As the sun sets, she is hungry, but there's no more bread to give her. The cement floor is cold tonight, and beneath the rags she shivers. And as the jet planes scorch the skies, she's longing for her brother. As the bombs fall in the distance, she wonders, will the next one fall much closer? It's not so far to Basra. I could be her father, 'cause when I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter. When I looked into her eyes, I saw my daughter.
From the studios of Freak Radio 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, you're tuned to the Weekly Freak Show on Party Town Radio, webcasting to the world at www.partytown.com/radio. Please have a pen and paper ready to take down our contact information at the end of this one-hour broadcast. That was David Rovix with this week's Spotlight Sound, My Daughter, from his most recently released CD, Living in These Times. In September 1998, Dennis Halliday, UN Assistant Secretary General and coordinator of the UN Oil for Food Program for Iraq, resigned in protest of the continuing economic embargo against the nation. In his resignation statement, Mr. Halliday affirmed that he could no longer take part in a policy that was deliberately causing grave and widespread suffering throughout Iraq, while failing to address the root causes of the humanitarian crisis. He cited growing malnutrition and incidences of infant mortality throughout Iraq, but also noted that prostitution was rising, school dropout rates were skyrocketing, and the entire country was under attack. After Mr. Halliday's resignation, Hans von Sponeck, a native of Germany, was named UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Iraq. In March 2000, after more than three decades in the UN, Hans von Sponeck also stepped down from the position in protest of the devastating effects of sanctions on the population of Iraq, saying they were deceitful and malicious. He joined Kathy Kelly in Santa Cruz on November 1st to discuss his experiences. Hans von Sponeck.
The story is a story of mistakes, the story of power politics, the story of wrongdoing. It started, in my opinion, in 1990 when sanctions were introduced, legitimately initially, to force a perpetrator of wrongdoing who had invaded another country to return back to norms of international behavior and leave Kuwait and behave. So that was fine. What was not fine was the immense international insensitivity towards those people who had absolutely nothing to do with that international conflict, with a conflict between a government that had done wrong and the international community. And these were the Iraqi people. If you remember, after the Second World War, when my country lost a brutal dictator and we had lost a war, we should have and must have lost. There was no alternative. It was a terrible wrongdoing that we committed. But at the end of this, when it was all over in May of 1945, what did the Germans get? The Germans got Marshall Plan aid, didn't we? We had a chance to reconstruct. We had a chance to rejoin civilized nations. When Iraq lost the Gulf War, they got sanctions. That already is a statement, in a way, of a double standard. Now you can say, wait a minute, they had to get something. Yes, they had to get something. But I think the major punishment was that they didn't get rid of their leader. We got rid of our leader. And when Iraq then was punished with sanctions in order to withdraw from Kuwait, and finally it withdrew from Kuwait, sanctions didn't end. Sanctions continued. The goalpost changed. Something else was introduced. Disarmament was introduced. And with it, a complicated network of nebulously formulated resolutions that allowed the UN or those in the UN, particularly the US and the British governments, to continuously arbitrarily apply international law in order to maintain the status quo. And that means that status quo has paid over handsomely in 11 years because it allowed a geostrategic presence in the Gulf. It allowed enormous shipments of arms into Saudi Arabia, into Kuwait, into Israel, and into other parts of the Middle East. It depleted the resources of many of the Middle Eastern countries, including Saudi Arabia. And without the villain Saddam Hussein, this would not have been possible. So it was good and useful to keep a man, a weak Saddam Hussein, in his box. It was much better, much preferred to no Saddam Hussein. Because without that, you wouldn't have had that demonized situation, the threat of a country that could possibly invade Saudi Arabia or return back to Kuwait. So comprehensive sanctions covering the entire country, 21 million at that time, Iraqis, had devastating effects very clearly. Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan, the UN Secretary General's representative, who went in 1999 to Iraq to look at the conditions, came back to New York and concluded he faced apocalyptic conditions in that country. That's the beginning of sanctions. Can you imagine what happened in 11 years or 10 years later? How much worse it must be today? Kathy has described some of these. Iraq, from one day to the next, was really stripped of its right as a nation. The oil revenue, no more oil. No more oil was pumped in these initial years. Whatever revenue there was, whatever assets there were, they were frozen. No foreign investment. The factories were closed down because no imports of essential spare parts. Unemployment rose. Hospitals quickly deteriorated further. The infrastructure was still largely in shambles because of the war. Bridges were down. Roads were in bad shape. The railroad didn't work. Aircraft had been flown to Iran, to Jordan, to Morocco, to Mauritania. Iraq had no more aircraft. So it was a country at a total standstill. And this then, over time, of course, this crisis, because of the comprehensiveness of sanctions, intensified. The British Parliament appointed 2 years ago a committee that published a report last year, which came to the conclusion on sanctions on Iraq that they hope no country will ever be subjected to such comprehensive sanctions again because of the damage that was done to the fabric of that nation. So we can safely conclude, and I can give you more examples, that sanctions of that kind, rather than being targeted, comprehensive, have failed. Saddam Hussein and his government is probably more stable government than many others in the Middle East. And the people are the ones who got the brunt of the punishment. That has been recognized. And the key question one must ask is, why, under these circumstances, did international policy led by your governments not lead to a change? Well, we can explore that later. Of course, I have an answer to this question. Under pressure, under intensifying pressures from the Middle East and from other governments, and also from people like you, the public conscience in Europe and in America has contributed to pressuring the policymakers in London and in Washington to reconsider. They don't do this voluntarily, but they are now doing it. So earlier this year, because of this pressure, something came out which was classified. It's wonderful how the politicians always find these slick, smooth formulations. It was called smart sanctions, intelligent sanctions, focused sanctions. I wonder whose intelligence they were referring to or for whom it was smart. Because if you look at what was proposed in the Security Council, and finally, because for once the Russians had a little bit of courage, turned down in June, was anything but smart or good or focused as far as the Iraqi people were concerned. The proposal that was turned down began by saying no more restrictions on civilian goods that come into Iraq across the borders of neighboring countries. So that looked good. If no more restrictions, then they could import what they need for life. That was a good beginning, but I keep saying that isn't equal to revitalizing, reviving, kickstarting the Iraqi economy that was not functioning. You travel through Iraq, you see most of the factories are empty, most of the factories are not functioning, and if they do, they function at a minimum of the capacity that prevailed before the sanctions. So it's a pitiful picture that can only be changed if you allow foreign investment and if you allow Iraqis to take charge of their money again. At the moment, every oil dollar that is officially earned goes into an account in Paris with the Banque Nationale de Paris. There the money is deposited. Iraq never gets a statement. Iraq is not party to a decision on how this money is invested or how the fees are being paid or whatever is being done to get a fair deal from an international bank. It's all done by the UN. The Central Bank of Iraq must beg the UN to give statements. If a UN official colleague of mine would hear, he would say it's wrong. Well, it is not wrong. They get general statements, but they do not get the details, or let alone are allowed to participate in any decision regarding the management of their money. And under smart sanctions, that would not change. There would still not be any permission even to invest in the oil industry. And the Iraqi oil industry is in shambles. It is in a dangerous state. I was always surprised that not a major environmental catastrophe occurred in Iraq because the UN Security Council does not allow, under sanctions, more than just a minor band-aid type of repair. No modernization, no new oil development, all the old overdue as far as replacement is concerned. It's in a very, very bad state. So smart sanctions wouldn't change any of that. That in itself isn't why I call this hideous or malicious or dishonest. The dishonesty comes in when one knows, and this is difficult. It took me a while to understand this malicious part. Under sanctions, Iraq doesn't get money for its recurrent budget. That means if the city here of Santa Cruz or any other city wouldn't have any money for the upkeep of your infrastructure, of your hospitals, of your schools, no money for the payment of teacher salaries or of civil servants, well, I think the community would dilapidate and would probably come to a standstill very, very quickly. In Iraq, that would also be the case. But Iraq exports oil illegally, gets it out into Turkey, gets it now out into Syria, and the smart sanctions say, wait a minute, no more smuggling. Sounds good, but the implications of that are so serious, because if you don't allow the government any more a penny to run the nation, then you're strangulating Iraq. And that's exactly what would happen under smart sanctions. Many, many governments are uneasy about it. Many governments have cautioned. The speaker of the Jordanian parliament in June said to me in Amman, said, if this goes ahead, it will bring down the Jordanian monarchy, because this trade involves people at many different levels. Alone across the Turkish border, where most of that illegal oil goes, 45,000 Turkish truck drivers are involved. It's their livelihood. If they can't anymore transport this illegal oil, then they have no income, they lose their jobs, and on average, one says in the developing world, one man or one woman who have a job, 10 people at least depend on this income. So that means 500,000 people would be suffering alone in the Kurdish parts of southeastern Turkey. So not only would in Iraq there would be a problem, but it would also be a political and economic problem in the countries surrounding Iraq. So smart sanctions are not smart at all. In fact, as somebody said, if we, after 11 years, introduce smart sanctions, how would one call the sanctions until then? Stupid or dumb or whatever. But in any case, I think the stupidity of the sanctions would continue under smart sanctions. And this is where I come in. You had the Oil for Food program. For many years, there was a conflict between Iraq and the UN international community because the Iraqis are very dignified people. The Iraqis didn't want to be a rich country, a country that was almost making the crossing towards a developed country because of their progressive investment in health, in education, in infrastructure. Here, they suddenly were reduced to holding out the hand and being dependent on the outside because they weren't allowed to pump oil. All of that created a resistance. We handled them badly, maybe deliberately, but the fact was that it took until May 1995 to agree on this Oil for Food program. And then it started in December. It took a long while. December of 96, it finally began. But what began was a very small smokescreen, fig leaf, whatever you want to call it, to hide the real implications of the sanction regime. because the initial amounts that were made available to feed, treat, medically treat, house, supply with clean water and electricity were pitiful amounts, $1.3 billion for then 21 million people. $1.3 billion. Take your calculator. What you get is $113 per person per year. $113 to finance everything. It was not in the pocket of individuals. It was to cover everything that was permissible under the sanctions. And that meant a wide range from agricultural inputs into water, into sanitation, into electricity, education, and of course primarily medicine and food. That alone consumed 80% of that $1.3 billion. So it was like a patient on the drip. When the patient stopped moving or moving less and there was a chance of a major human tragedy, the United Nations Security Council decided to add some resources. So after 2 years, the amount was doubled. Instead of 1.3, $2.6 billion for humanitarian supplies became available for the subsequent phases. And what I didn't mention is that out of every dollar earned for the sale of oil, 30 cents were taken out and put into a different pot to pay compensation mainly to the Republic of Kuwait and to other governments and to individuals and organizations for alleged losses as a result of Iraq's invasion into Kuwait. And there was massive cheating. People came, Swiss Air said they sold tickets that they needed to be reimbursed. Israel said the flour export has suffered, they had a claim of this much. The Kuwaitis came and said, well, we want for lost sale of our oil, because they didn't sell oil during the Iraq-Kuwait war, we want compensation, and so it went.
And that's all the time we have this week. Thanks for listening. The weekly Freak Show is produced live in the studios of Freak Radio, 96.3 FM in Santa Cruz, California, and can also be heard on Radio Left, liberal and progressive radio for people who care throughout the world at www.radioleft.com. The interviews featured in this program are only a sample of the fine shows each week on Freak Radio. To hear it all 24 hours a day, listen online at www.microradio.net/FRSC. That's www.microradio.net/FRSC. For questions and comments, send email to frsc@microradio.net. That's frsc@microradio.net. Or snail mail to P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. That's P.O. Box 7507, Santa Cruz, California 95061. Or call area code 831-427-4523. That's 831-427-4523. Thanks to the A-Infos Radio Project for distribution. Our theme music was arranged and performed by Neil Norman and his Cosmic Orchestra. For everyone here at Freak Radio, my name's the V-Man, and that's a wrap.